Greetings, dear listeners. You are listening to the dulcet intonations of Jackson Hogan, podcasting to you by popular demand. My podcast is modestly titled, Jackson Illuminates Everything About Skiing. For a man who claims to be the pontiff of powder, alleging that I know everything isn't much of a stretch. Instead, it's sort of expected. As the title suggests, I plan to talk about all aspects of alpine skiing, from the mundane to the metaphysical. I will, of course, be doing interviews with personalities I've come to know over a four-decade career, but I'll also share with you one-on-one, as it were, my insights as to how everything works. Your skis, your boots, your bindings, the market that sells this stuff, boot fitting, ski tuning, product development, skier safety issues, even the rental market. I know it all because I've done it all. I can't wait to share it with you in this intimate setting.
Ah, there you are, Gregory.
Yes, I'm sorry with these intrusions, but they're trying to sell me healthcare on an automated system.
As if you don't have enough healthcare already. Look at all the healthcare you've got.
I have got a pretty good program right now. I won't go into
Those sort of details. It's not that type of podcast, ladies and gentlemen. This, we're up to about chapter 3 in the Chronicles of Stumpy here. The last time, my subject here, the wonderful Greg Stump, the cineast who brought us the Legend of Oz, as well as the Blizzard of Oz and other titles, was droning on and on about some accomplishment of his or other to the point of my ennui. So I've decided that we should change the subject. Let's talk about, instead about you, let's talk about us. Because I recall when, in fact, we first met. I have two vivid recollections that sort of bracket our first meeting. One is a morning breakfast after an absolute wonderful evening before that I had totally misbehaved, resulting in a brutal hangover. And I wasn't requesting service at our breakfast table, which we shared. I was yelling for it. I was the typical guy you don't want to be with.
No, he was the ugly, ugly American.
I was the ugly American.
On howling, Fashion Island.
Howling for service in this fancy French restaurant.
Why were we having breakfast?
That was because what we do in the morning.
I know, but
it was. The night before had been the fundraiser. The night before had been the actual, raise the money for the U.S. ski team. 1986.
We must have had conversation.
We might have conversed at that particular point in time.
Meet me for breakfast.
But no, the first time I remember seeing you standing was actually on a tennis court. And
all 5'5" of me?
Yes. And so I watched you.
Dear listeners, this is pre-Michael Chang days, right? So there were no short tennis players.
He had no role models is what he's
I had no
to say.
Role models.
So I'm sitting there watching Stump with this sort of preposterous toss, wind up, and swing for the fences, and I delivered the immortal line, "Who taught you how to serve? Your mother?"
No, and this is out loud. We're playing doubles. All right, so I'm playing with a friend of mine who's traveling with me doing this tour because we were showing Maltese Flamingo at this U.S. Ski Team fundraiser, and Jackson freshly. Not working at Solomon anymore, had absolutely zero guardrails on his behavior. Right? I mean, so in other words, he's still hungover. Now he's playing tennis. But, okay, Jackson, how tall are you?
I'm just shy of 6 foot squares. I'm 5'8 and 5'11 and change.
Okay. So he's tall enough, taller than me. Right? And, obviously good athlete and, who taught me to serve? Who taught you to serve? Your mother? Because I had a terrible serve. Because unlike Jackson, I didn't go to private freaking prep school Andover, where he probably had Ely Nastasi, teaching
yes,
class.
I had several private coaches and trainers.
Yeah,
and
I bet you did have Ely. If that Ely left a mark on you, let me tell you.
That was funny stuff. I think it was the same day or it was the next day that Tom Wheeler, who was then a sort of a marketing rep, whatever that means for Solomon, came to me and said, "We need you. We need you. And I'm dressed for tennis. I'm wearing tennis garb." He said, "We need you to race Ken Reed." And I said, "What?" I said, "You can't possibly need me to race Ken Reed."
If you don't know who Ken Reed is, one of the crazy Canucks,
right?
In World Cup downhill, won a bunch.
Oh, yeah. He was at least a 5-time World Cup downhill winner and won Kitzbühel, which is not for children. and he ushers me over. I'm still wearing tennis shorts. And tennis shorts in those days, by the way, didn't leave a lot to the imagination. You know, we wrote them hot.
That's why I played. That's the reason I took up the sport.
So there I am, and I said, well, I have no equipment. And so he says, no worries, we have a rental shop. We're going to race Ken Reed. Race Ken Reed's up there in full regalia, right? He's probably got a Canadian ski team outfit on. I'm in my tennis shorts. I've been given the SX31 Salomon rental boot, which is as low on the product pyramid as you can go. The only thing retaining this gear in the boot is the power of prayer. There's nothing else going on. And, of course, I coveted rental ski.
So as an atheist, this must have been especially challenging.
Yes, I was facing my imminent demise. Correct. The snow surface was room service ice.
Dear God, I know this is the first time I've called you.
The catering department basically filled up dump trucks and dumped them down the ramps of the parking garage above the Meridian. Yeah. And that was our race course. I put on a good show. I beat all the chum that was hired to try to take me out. And then I faced Ken Reed in the finals of this US ski team, you know, rental equipment against race equipment.
Was it a straight course?
Well, there wasn't a lot of room. That's not a room to negotiate in the garage ramp areas. So we had to have two side-by-side courses. So, no, we didn't have a lot of turn radius involved.
Right. Okay. So you just...
Mercifully, there's no... Or you just threw yourself down the hill. I mean, what the hell? What is racing anyway? Right. You throw yourself down the hill.
So, the pile of ice cubes.
I hurled myself in an attempt to kind of catch Reed at the finish line, but to no avail, but to great popular appeal. And that was an insane event. I mean, I didn't even get a cigarette lighter or something like that for my efforts.
You have it in your memory, and I'm sure we can call Ken, and he probably.
Oh, okay. I'm sure it is emblazoned on Ken's memory. Actually, I spent some other time with Ken Reed. Actually, we've had a wonderful dinner in Geneva at the end of the Salomon ski intro, and we've skied together in several different venues. So actually, this was not the only occasion.
Yeah, he's a good egg.
He's a very good egg. Yeah.
I know him well, but I saw him four or five times at Whistler, and we always had interesting conversations, and he's just had that class act.
Oh, yeah. And he also had, like, Richard Gere good looks, and he had a very personable manner. There was no hauteur about him at all.
No.
He was very, very much a fellow skier type of thing. And anyway, great, great guy.
Plus, he knew I was better than him, so there was no point.
The next time we got to spend, the only time we really got to spend a lot of time together during what we might call a large period of time, decades or more, was when I had just been told to find other employment by Head. And on the way out, they said, oh, by the way, finish this movie. We've had these Canadians shoot this footage and really don't know what the heck to do with it. And we've contracted with this guy, Greg Stump, to put it all together. So we want you to sort of represent Head's interest in the editing of this movie. Well, of course, there was nothing but raw footage. There was no story. There was nothing except incoherent.
See, I actually didn't know that part. And I wrestled the job away from this guy in Whistler who was just going to fuck it up even more.
It was not shot from a script. It was shot.
No, well,
by the way, listeners, is the way a lot of ski movies are done. I've done a few ski movies, not just with Greg, and it's like a recipe made in reverse.
Well, and we weren't allowed to use a lot of the footage that your guy
shot. Exactly, because it was sacred. I won't go into all the sacredness of it, because I thought it was profane, but it was sacred. But I was sent forth to make a movie.
I inherited by my own will, because I was going to make a bunch of money, and I'm selling my soul. I'm going to fix this thing, because it can be fixed. Enter Jackson Hogan.
I fly to Hawaii to get on a cab and go to Kihei or whatever.
No, I picked you up at the airport.
Okay.
That's when you were in the foul mood about the New York Times crossword.
Oh, yes. I mean, you know.
I was going to tell that story.
Yeah, well, you've Hall of Fame. Moving right along to our next.
No, you said you want to talk about us. So I picked Jackson up at the airport, pissed off about the New York Times crossword puzzle. I won't tell the whole punchline or anything, but he's just pissed off. He's pissed off because he does this in his sleep. And so now he arrives in Hawaii in a bad mood because he's missing, 19 down. And I'm like, fucking, what's the problem, dude? Really? And he goes, yeah, a presidential proclamation. And I go, ich nein ein Berliner. And Jackson looked at me like, I didn't know if you were going to punch me.
At that time, my childhood probably flashed before me. I was probably feeling all sorts of different things.
Well, I didn't push the issue. We got in the car. I just picked up a Swamp Cooler air conditioner.
By the way, a salt cooler air conditioner whose dimensions exceeded Greg's own by a factor of at least two.
Yeah, not anymore. I've sold out.
Please continue.
Yeah, so I've got this air conditioner in the back of my 1980 Mazda station wagon, which was my Hawaii car. But it was like this beat up old, you know, it was a windsurf car and surf car. But anyway, get Jackson, get over to the condo. Now, I have this condo that I bought in like 1985 because I was a windsurfer at this really nice condo complex. It's just windy as hell there, which is why I bought there. And Jackson had to stay there. And that's where my studio was, up three flights of stairs, outdoor stairs, concrete. And we get to the place, and I guess I'm probably dragging.
Well, he's wrestling with it. It's not easy to manipulate this thing under any circumstances. The staircase doesn't help by having these landings in between that make cornering rather difficult with this thing. And Stumpy is sweating like Patrick Ewing at the foul line. I mean, it is just pouring off him in rivulets, as the great Harvey Corbett said.
I'm the little reindeer, the dog with the reindeer thing stuck to his head in the Grinch. That's what I was. And sweating. But, you know, and Jackson's got all his luggage.
So we're just hauling this stuff upstairs. So he just looks at me. It's a lot more professional than it looks. As the swamp cooler tries to take him back down a flight of stairs or so.
No, because I had a really cool functioning studio that was actually really cool. But it had air conditioning was illegal at Luana Kai. You don't need the air conditioning if you leave your windows open, but keep this thing airtight because it was so windy, the dust that would come through would fuck up your computers and machines. Anyway, so I really needed an air conditioner, and the swamp cooler was the only solution. I knew right where it was going to get. Everything's all set up for it, but I picked it up right before I picked up Jackson at the airport. So A, he can't finish the New York Times cross the table. B, we get to the Luana Kai, and I'm humping that thing up there. But then the end result was really,
the story doesn't quite end there, ladies and gentlemen. I was asked then to record my narration. We ended up splitting the narration duties. And I was ushered into this hobbit-sized bathroom, in which it was almost impossible to turn around before you added the 6-inch thick layers of waffle foam that don't quite adhere to any surface. I'm not sure they could have given the humidity involved.
There was a mattress in there standing up on it, too.
Keep the sound dampening out. So I'm sitting there trying to keep the walls of foam from closing in too much upon me. Yes.
Fine. No, they weren't. It was a very
working conditions.
Sound efficient. Right. Primitive, but the sound.
Yeah. And that's all that matters, ladies and gentlemen.
It was. You're the narrator.
Mere narrator.
Shut up. Narrate.
Oh, and by the way, write some more of it too. Right. I didn't like the last stuff you wrote. That was no good at all. So go write some more. And this was definitely scripted on the run.
And then the microphone, I was using a Tram Lavalier, which Danny Techhead will know as the best lavalier microphone brand. So I had a Tram microphone mounted behind a clothes hanger that was shaped out, and then ladies' panties, okay? And that was the Sibilance Buster that I had over this Tram microphone. It sounds nutty, but it worked. It sounded great. And not just ladies' panties, ladies' nylons, so the air could go through them. It was a functioning Sibilance Buster. I got it from MacGyver.
As you can see, ladies and gentlemen, everything was top rate. Top rate.
Well, yeah, the sound was. And that's all that matters.
You should, if you ever, by the way, look Jackson. For it, young, you know, budding cineast, your collection is not complete unless you have a copy of what became called Hotel Bella Coola. By the way, I contributed beforehand only in getting the athletes up there. I think I engaged Darian Boyle and...
Oh, look at you trying to distance
yourself.
Well,
I had been distanced by being fired, which was a very effective distancing tool. I felt much more distant after that. They continued to pay me rather nicely for a while, but it was all sort of like having a fatal disease. You knew it was going to end. You knew the ending wasn't going to be good. What other sort of escapades? Oh, yes, we had to shoot some footage at the Clockworks for Legend of Oz.
Well, we're still on Maui. Do you want to talk about the golf?
No, but I know you did. So I'll just set it up for you. Stubby is noticeably anxious because I'm there for only like 5 or most 6 days or something like that. And he's rather expected to do a finished product. And he's got to be somewhere near the finish line before I suddenly take off. And we're now at Friday or maybe even at Saturday. The finish line is not anywhere in sight.
No, it's not even a mast on the horizon.
Exactly. And he suggests some dawn patrol commencement of work. I pry my eyes open and look at him, and I said, you know, gentlemen commonly take the day off on the weekend. Or something to that effect. Something.
No. I know. He says, what was typically people left typically on the weekend. And I'm just like, do you have any idea how far? I didn't say this, but I'm thinking, I go, okay, no problem. The client doesn't understand how much work.
Exactly. I was living and breathing empathy. How client, else was client, I going to get back to Kihei on someone else's nickel to play golf unless we simply declare golf day?
Sure. And now, again, just like tennis. Now, Jackson went to Yale. Probably was like, you know,
I was probably were on the golf team. They had a beautiful golf course, but believe me, I couldn't have found a golf ball with either hand in those days. I was not an adept.
You got better.
But I know you're dying to tell the story, so I'll stand back.
Well, it's in Wailuku, Maui, so it's the course on the ocean. But it's not a big touristy course because it's windy, and that's the North Shore. But that's where the Hawaiians and the Japanese and Whitey doesn't usually go there, right? But Jackson and I go there. It's not like $8,000 for the day.
Yeah, the tariff was reasonable.
Felt like it was challenging to me because I don't play golf. At that point, I probably played 30 times in my life, again, without instruction. Unlike Yale boy.
Yeah, Yale boy was, if you ever watched my golf game, you would realize I was largely self-taught as well, I'm afraid. But at any rate.
It was hot and humid. Jackson's wearing white golf pants.
Probably tennis shorts, knowing me.
And we already talked about how tennis shorts are revealing. Well, we're on the ocean. It's a little windy. And I'd go with a dozen balls. And I was probably close to running out at that point. And Jackson shoots a drive or hits a drive. Well, I don't know what I call it in golf, but he tees off and hits a masterful shot. It's beautiful, but he shits himself at the same time as in the swing.
Slight in his white shorts. But yes,
no, but okay, his pants turn brown. He's an asshole. All right.
Much more scientific I don't know explanation. Much more scientific. Yeah,
dear listener, does that qualify as a pants shitting? I say yes,
but unproven allegation.
Okay. But then he turns around and says, did you see my shot? And I'm like, you're fucking kidding me. You just shit your pants. I was trying to.
Oh, we're playing with two Japanese tourists who understood just enough English to probably just not know what to do. They've been much too polite to actually break out in laughter, but they were just, I think, horrified by the situation. Not the first nor the last to ever feel that way.
Well, and it puts a whole new bent on mind if I play through.
Oh, yes, by all means, as fast as humanly possible. Now, if I could just turn the tables for a moment, since we have so many colorful, legendary moments to revisit, I was working for Panoptics, which is a brand of sort of arcane sunglasses that was popular with Harley riders, because Harley riders don't wear visors and other helmets, because those are apparently for non-Harley riders only. So they have to wear something over their eyes or they'll go blind. So they adopted our brand. And it also had a ski application because they were sunglasses that had a goggle-like gasket inside them so you could actually ski a sunglass at Mach Schnell and your eyes wouldn't bleed. So we had a booth at the SIA show. In those days, the SIA show was still something of an important event. Everyone had to go. It's certainly in its decline right now, and who knows what it'll survive like in the future. But I'm getting off track. So I'm at the
Panoptics. Well, it was the last one that was held in Las Vegas.
And in walks Stumpy, and he is in fine fettle. He is appropriately coiffed, dressed like the perfect gentleman, and he is accompanied by two of the, let's say, more seasoned hookers.
They were young,
but still looked seasoned.
No, and I had just met them in the hallway.
So he adopts them.
I said to them, will you guys hang out with me for like 3 or 4 hours? And they're like, sure, can you pay us? And I'm like, fuck yeah, just pretend like we're just really good friends. And I gave them each like $100. They were like stoked. Like, what do we do? Go, well, let's go to the bar. And so they've been working all night. Like, I meet them in the the hotel lobby. But they were, see, to me, they were cute, Jackson. I saw their inner beauty.
My boss was horrified. He failed to see the humor in it. And of course, if you failed to see the humor in it, you kind of failed it altogether. It had to be appreciated for its humorous aspects. And our,
otherwise,
our booth was not an attractant anyway. People weren't stampeding to get our funky sunglasses, I'm sorry to say.
So these skanky horrors really...
Oh, they certainly were an unusual spin on having, you know, like booth hostesses and whatnot.
Well, did more people show up or was everybody...
Well, let's put it this way. It didn't turn out to be what people were looking for in an eyewear provider. Jeopardizing my career at that point was... Okay, sure. Why not? let's have the hookers and let's have them hang out here for a while. Besides, there was no point in trying to shoo them away. They would only insist on staying. So Vegas-based, and since we're talking about me, and I, like you, enjoy the topic immensely, you saw me work a stand-up routine in Las Vegas, right across from the convention center, one evening as the show wrapped up.
Yeah, my business partner at the time, Carl Labby. Glenn Plake wouldn't be in ski movies without Carl Labby. But that's another story. But he's also the one that noticed you. And he goes, you got to see this guy. I'm like, what is he doing? He's the Pope. I'm like, huh? And Carl was Catholic from northern Maine, Fort Kent.
Nice.
Yeah.
So he drags you off to see this guy, Hogan, who was, in fact, wearing a papal hat, a beautiful...
A meter.
Yes, and a white linen suit because I really didn't have robes. But I had Christy Brown on one arm and Kim Reichelm on the other. These are gals who are both about 5'11 and stunning.
And great skiers and great
God, incredible skiers. Incredible. And they escorted me to the stage. And then I said, thank you, ladies. I'll take it from here. And just had a ball. And I knew, just like any presenter, you know within the first 30 seconds if you're going to be in charge of this group or is it going to be the other way around. And it was a great audience. So I warmed to the task, shall we say.
Carl made me get there early because it was packed. And no, you just killed it. I mean, it was like a Steve Martin type performance. And I'm just like, I didn't know you'd done it before. I just was like, whoa, is this guy just riffing this? Because it was really funny.
Yes, it was unscripted, ladies and gentlemen.
At that point, so I knew it was you.
Right. So that's, so that established my
identity. The Meridian from the insult at my tennis.
Yes.
That's the time I saw you. I think it is.
We played Connect the Dots. Then we spent another long collaboration on another movie called Legend of Oz. You're one of the few people in the world who's really equipped to describe what went on before I showed up, why I showed up, and what little I may have contributed while I was there in my role as some form of executive producer for the film.
Yes, yes. Well, as you have in your bio, it was some kind of psychological support for Greg Stone.
Yes, a therapy of sorts.
Oh, what is it exactly that you have in your bio?
Oh, I'm a personal therapist, I say. Personal therapist.
Personal therapist. Okay, dear listeners, if you're still listening. Well, what? I think that's absolutely true, because that was a daunting project on so many levels, because, again, being ultimately the one-man wrecking ball, it was more than one person could handle. It was and Bob Nunn's input, your input, Bob Nunn's. You guys are really the only two people I listen to.
But listening didn't necessarily propel you forward at a breakneck pace.
No, well, the thing was, it's such a challenging. I mean, I bit off more than I could chew by going into ski movie history, and that was I'm covering like 80 topics at once. Not 80, but.
No, you did set a bold agenda. Let the history of ski film wedded to the history of stump, wedded to the arc of filmmaking. For some reason, my solution to what I perceived to be your sort of creative doldrums was to send you song lyrics, original song lyrics, I must say. I didn't plagiarize anything.
I never read one of them.
I read
one of them.
22 of you never read
nuts.
One of them.
Nuts. No, I thought this guy's nuts. But it did distract me.
I remember shooting some other footage though. It was me and the Pontiff, but
yes, and that was later, during Legend of Oz. But this was like the shoot up this circus I had going on. in Victor in Idaho at that crazy house.
It was hilarious scene, ladies and gentlemen. We were all summoned from different places. It was like an Agatha Christie story. There was people from all over God's creation, all thrown together. We had fabulous lodging. I was put in a huge outdoor, well, I guess tents are inherently outdoor. I guess all buildings are outdoor unless you're inside them.
It was in the grotto.
It's a gorgeous tent.
It was in the grotto with the apple tree.
Oh, absolutely lovely.
And the little statues, and you had your own pulpit.
Yeah, and we had, when we got to the filming, I had a pulpit, and then I had a hot tub.
I had a pulpit long before we filmed. I bought that pulpit like 2 years earlier, because I saw it at an estate sale, and I was going, oh, what is this? It's a pulpit. Like, will you deliver it? <They're> like, yes. I'll take it.
Yeah.
Because that thing was cool. It was real.
It was a quality pulpit.
It came out of a church. It wasn't faux.
No. I remember the first time I met Casey. She was in the back of a limo. We were off in Colorado trying to see if we could drum up some sort of distribution system for Legends. I'm all, once again, my shorts are in a knot probably over the travel arrangements, which I don't manage well. Stumpy finally arrives. Well, maybe not finally. Might have been right on time, but to me, I was in such a state. So I opened the back door of the limo, not expecting anything but the back end of a limo. And there is this stunning brunette with hair down to her navel looking at me as coy as can be. And I'm just going, what is this? What is something? What have you done?
Well, you left out Scott Schmidt.
Oh, Schmidt also, I don't even remember Scott Schmidt.
Casey
was like being hit in the head with a hammer.
Oh, yeah. No, trust me. Bring it down. I like that hammer.
Yeah, that hammer still cohabitates with you. How many years have you been together now? How long ago was that?
14, 15. And that was before we were just we're just working together at that point.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, we pick you up in a limo. So you, Scott Schmidt, Casey. That was pretty funny.
That was. Well, I think I'm feeling the end of an episode being upon us, that sort of slight lull in the conversation. We have plenty more to talk about, but we should do that when we whip up the next batch of the Chronicles of Stump.
Yes, indeed. I think it's a good time to go.
Fare thee well, listeners. Thank you for your patience and your calm demeanor throughout. And I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.
Au revoir. Au revoir.